They'd had enough. They pulled back and licked their wounds, leaving their dead behind them. We weren't in much better shape. I did a head count and came up with 7 survivors. We'd lost half our original number, and we weren't out of these tunnels yet. Chapter 14. The rest of the mission was a sweaty haze. I kept thinking of Natasha and how she died on my back. There'd been nothing I could do. It was galling. I tried to push those thoughts away. Lots of people had died. It was no big deal. If we could get out of here, we could all cry about it later. We huddled in the tunnel for the next hour, treating our wounded and talking about what we should do. We were down to 7 recruits, and all of us were as raw and inexperienced as they came.
"Graves put McGill in charge," Carlos said to the rest. "Yeah, I know it's crazy, but I heard it. Granted, he was probably certifiable by that point. 1 second later, he ran into the middle of a pack of juggers and offered up his juicy parts."
"It was a noble sacrifice," I said. Carlos scoffed.
"Yeah, right. He knew he could be back in camp sipping coffee in a few hours while we're still stuck in this rat hole."
"I didn't see you doing it."
Carlos snorted, but he did finally shut up. The peace that fell over the group once he stopped yapping was blissful. No one else felt much like talking. We were all thinking too much about the grim fate that probably awaited us when the next charge came. Plasma grenades weren't cheap. We couldn't make them on Earth, and they cost galactic credits real money to buy. For that reason, only a few troops had them. Weaponeers and officers who requisitioned a charge for their own personal use. Graves' grenade was the only one we'd brought down here with us. So we were left with snap rifles, a few extra magazines, and our combat knives. The dead were all around us to remind us what might happen any minute. The group was in a depressed mood. I took a deep breath and struggled to my feet. I pushed away Carlos's hand and took a few painful steps on stiff legs.
"Maybe dying would do you some good," Carlos observed. "Fastest way to heal up."
I frowned at him. "Enough with the quitter routine. Graves put me in charge. Get up, everyone. We're moving out of this damn tunnel."
"Where?"
demanded Kiwi. She was the last living woman on the team. Her eyes were big, blue, and a little crazy. Carlos jumped in before I could answer. He pointed down the tunnel.
"Back to the shafts. If there is going to be a rescue, it has to come from that direction."
I slapped his hand down and pointed in the opposite direction.
"We're going to see where this shaft leads." They all looked at me like I was mad. I had to admit they could be right, but I didn't care. I wanted to complete our mission. I wanted to know where the enemy was coming from.
"Look," I said to them. "We're screwed anyway. We might as well find out how they got into the mine."
"We'll all die for sure," Kiwi said. "What's the point of that?"
"If we find the end point, we'll have completed the mission. When they revive any one of us who's been down here, we'll report then."
Carlos stepped forward and put a hand on my arm.
"Hey, McGill," he said, "I don't want to rain on your parade, but your idea could get us permed."
I frowned at him until he pulled his hand away.
"What are you talking about?"
"That's one of the ways it happens.
It's against galactic law to copy anyone who's not confirmed dead. If we wander down into the bowels of this shit planet and get burned to ash by lava or something, they won't be able to ID our bodies. No ID, no reconstruction. Permadeath."
I paused, having not considered that possibility. Throughout our battle so far, we'd been on the surface and easily located by sensor equipment. Down here, however, it was a different story. We were cut off by the planet's metallic soil. No one back at HQ knew if we were alive or dead. Probably they hadn't revived any of the team members yet. Not even Harris. They wouldn't do it until they had some kind of confirmation, which I doubt they had yet. I shook my head.
"Doesn't matter,"
I said. I'm not talking about walking 10 miles or jumping into any lava chambers. I'm talking about exploring this tunnel. What's the difference if we're a few hundred meters farther away from the shaft when they get down here?
It's a risk.
One which I'm willing to take, I said, and I began walking. They grumbled, but they were used to following unreasonable orders, so they fell into line. I headed down the tunnel in the lead, not having the heart to order anyone else to take point. This was my idea, after all. The least I could do was get myself eaten first. As we progressed, it did seem that the level of heat in the tunnel was increasing. I didn't know what to make of that. All Carlos's talk of lava chambers might have had me spooked, or it might be real. Check the external temp, I said, halting. Carlos frowned and did as I suggested.
No change, he said.
He looked toward Kiwi, who was next in line. She shook her head, looking from her tapper.
Nothing.
I frowned and examined my systems. I found a fault within seconds.
It's me, I said.
My suit must have been damaged during that last fight. Really, I'm not surprised.
You've got a leak?
Maybe, either that or my air conditioner is dying.
Bad way to go. This planet runs a fever of 40 degrees Celsius, even underground.
I shrugged. I'll be hot, but I'll survive. The tunnels won't broil me the way the open land would. I kept going. We'd gone far more than 100 meters. We'd gone at least 1,000, but as my troops weren't complaining, I didn't stop. After nearly 3 kilometers had passed, however, Carlos tapped me on the shoulder.
McGill, this is crazy, man. This tunnel might run 40 kilometers for all we know, and the rescue party might be behind us, baffled as to where we went.
I leaned against the wall of the tunnel and sipped water. My suit's reservoir was running low. All right, I said at last. Let's give it 10 more minutes. We march that much farther, then turn around. They groaned, but they followed. I had to admit that even I was giving up hope. 15 minutes later, we rounded a slight bend in the tunnel and saw daylight, only 100 meters ahead. That was a stunner. We crouched, stared, and zoomed with our optics. We spoke in whispers, despite the fact we couldn't see any lizards.
I can't believe it,
Carlos said. He was working on his tapper, bringing up data.
My GPS doesn't work down here. No surprise. But the computer counts every step you take. I reset the counter when we started. We marched over 4 frigging kilometers. 10 minutes? You're such a liar, McGill. I hate you.
I found the way out, didn't I?
I said, smiling.
Okay. What we're going to do is poke our noses out. Take off your safeties and be ready for anything.
I took a half step, but Carlos's hand fell on my wrist. I pulled it away and almost shoved him. He'd never dare try that crap if I had real rank on him.
McGill, James,
he asked, shaking his head in disbelief.
It's over, man. You found what you wanted. Let's get the hell out of here.
That's what I intend to do. I'm going to march out of this tunnel and radio our report in. They can come pick us up. That will be much faster than walking back.
But they don't have any air power. That wasn't in the contract. We'd have to wait for the ship to send down a lander or walk all the way back through the forest.
I thought hard for a second. The rest of them looked scared. We all knew that going out onto the surface was dangerous. Walking through that forest was going to be close to suicide, and my suit's AC was already failing. But I wanted to see where this tunnel went. The answer was so close I couldn't give up now. I came up with an angle that I thought would give them a good reason to follow me.
Listen, I said. This is all about avoiding permadeath at this point. If we walk out there and get wiped, well, at least the finish will be recorded by our GPS systems. We'll be back in camp within an hour, healthy and fresh. If we stay down here in this hole, anything could happen. We're all taking the risk of being permed if we stay in the tunnels.
In the end, their fear of getting permed outweighed their fear of being overrun by hungry lizards. They complained and gave me frustrated groans, but at last they pulled it together and followed me to the mouth of the tunnel. We crept up to the glaring entrance. The mouth was overgrown and half filled with sifting mud. It was raining outside and relatively cool. The green canopy of the jungle softened the glaring sky, and as our eyes adjusted, it no longer seemed brilliantly bright. We sat just inside the entrance for several minutes, listening to the rain and talking in whispers.
"Do you see anything?"
Carlos asked me.
"Trees. That's about it."
"No lizards?"
I looked at him in disgust.
"Don't you think I would have mentioned that?"
I was closest to the entrance. The rest of the team hung back with their rifles aimed at the opening. They looked extremely nervous. I tried to see them through the confident eyes of Graves. He'd never have let his troops see him worried, especially if he was worried. I straightened my back and stared out into the jungle. "You still can't get anything?" I asked Carlos.
"Nothing. Not from inside. Damn these metal walls."
Without further discussion, I moved out of the tunnel. I had to crawl to get past the debris-choked entrance. Mud had slid down into the hole, and I thought it must have been a tight squeeze for a jugger, even when it was freshly dug. I walked outside in a crouch, trying to look everywhere at once. A flock of flying reptiles screeched at me and took wing. Their flapping, leathery wings made snapping noises in the air, and they showered me with dark gray guano.
"What's going on?" Carlos hissed.
I looked around for a second longer, then returned to the tunnel entrance.
"Not much. Looks clear.
Come on up." They did so, reluctantly. They were all working their tappers soon, but they didn't operate.
"I can't connect," Kiwi complained. "It's just saying, syncing with network, and keep spinning."
Everyone had the same problem.
"Maybe we're too far out from base."
Carlos shook his head.
"No, no way. These things can reach 10 miles or more."
"Can they get a signal from Corvus?"
asked Kiwi. We glanced at her, then tried it, but it was no good.
"Our basic tappers aren't strong enough. I bet an officer could do it."
"The techs can. I've seen them do it." Carlos made a pinwheeling gesture of exasperation with his arms.
"Well, that's just great. They give recruits the best of everything, don't they? Shit guns, shit suits, shit comm equipment. The trouble is, we're the only ones left alive. If I'd known, I would have stripped Graves and left him naked for the dinos."
I was working my tapper, ignoring him. I was deep in the confusing options screens. I'd spent some time poking around in there, but hadn't figured out what every screen did. Now there was a serious reason to do so.
"Let's set up a local network, so we can at least talk to one another."
"What the hell for?"
I gave him an irritated glance. Before I could answer, Kiwi spoke up.
"That's a great idea," she said. "We'll set up our own little net, then make it discoverable. Anyone else with a system more powerful than ours might detect it. They could receive our weak signals, and if they did a little work, link up with us."
I nodded as if that had been my idea. In truth, I just figured we could communicate if we were separated. Carlos came near looking over my shoulder to stare at my option screens.
"Well, look at the big brain on you," he said. "I guess you learned something in school before you dropped out."
I considered punching him, and I almost did, but it would have been counterproductive at this point, so I saved it for later.
"Well, I have a fix on the GPS on our location, at least. Camp is that way."
I didn't get an argument after that. They followed me toward camp. We hadn't gone 100 steps before we found digging equipment, a big pile of loose shale. It shone with metallic, spiraling strips of metal.
"They bored in and took pains to hide the evidence," I said. "They knew we'd be watching from Corvus."
I nodded, and we pressed on. What we came to next startled us. It was a lizard camp with sleeping nests and campfires. The surprising thing was the massive size of it. The camp stretched for over a mile.
"There must have been thousands of them here," Kiwi said.
"Yeah. But where do they all go? I asked. I walked into the deserted camp, and for nearly a minute, no one followed me. They hung back at the edge of the jungle. I looked back and laughed at them.
What? Do you think you're safe standing there behind trees? If they aren't gone, we're all dead anyway. Come on!
They followed me at last. As we walked, we all took video with our suit cameras and tappers. If they wanted detailed data, that would give it to them.
Isn't this weird?
Carlos asked me as we passed the massive camp.
I mean, we would always leave behind a few troops in a camp this big.
Yeah, they aren't us. They don't have non-combatants in their armies. They all fight, every one of them.
We shouldn't walk straight to our base from here. If they are hitting it and retreat, we'll run right into them.
I stopped, frowning. The rest pulled up behind us, nervously watching every tree.
You're right.
Let's veer off at a 90-degree angle for a kilometer or so. We should be out of their path then. We turned and walked away from the alien camp and our own base for a time. The jungle became deeper, and the suns began going down. In truth, that was a blessing. I was overheating in daylight. My suit's AC was operating, but only barely. I could feel every outlet of cool air trickling down inside my suit, drying sweat as it went. It was barely enough to keep me from getting heat stroke. About 2 kilometers later, I called a halt. Everyone worked their tappers. We still couldn't connect with the base network.
Something's wrong, Carlos complained. This can't be right. We were only 2 or 3 kilometers out. I know our signal should reach this far.
I privately agreed with him, but didn't want to make a big deal out of it. Let's keep marching, I said, doing my best to sound like Graves. It will sort itself out soon enough. Kiwi wouldn't let it go.
Yeah, Carlos is right. This is all wrong. There are too many repeaters. They can't all be down.
Look, I said. Maybe their power is down, I don't know.
That doesn't make any sense. In order for...
Kiwi, I said, interrupting her. There's nothing we can do about it. Let's keep moving, not talking. We're easy meals out here. Talk of being eaten got them all moving again. After nearly an hour, it finally was dark, and we came within sight of the walls. They didn't look good. Using our night vision equipment, we could see they were damaged, and the entire area was filled with a pall of smoke.
They're dead, Carlos whispered with sudden panicked certainty. They're all dead. That's the only answer.
They can't all be dead, I told him.
We're screwed, he said, not even looking at me. Look at those walls. There's no one up there. Big holes punched right through. No network. We're screwed, totally screwed.
We were hugging a bushy area about 200 meters from camp. It looked quiet. Too quiet.
If we die now, they won't even be able to revive us, Kiwi said.
She had the same panicky tone Carlos had. It was becoming infectious.
Everyone who's died, they're already burned.
We'll be fine, I said with a certainty I didn't feel.
James, our data is here. On the planet,
Kiwi said.
Even if they did transfer it up, they have no way of knowing if we're alive or not. They can't produce a copy of any of us without being certain.
Oh, God, Carlos said. Varys did it again. My first damn time out.
Did what?
Kiwi asked.
What are you, an idiot? They wiped... You know what I'm talking about, McGill. Just like I told you back on Earth, the Legion is gone.
I stared at the walls quietly. Kiwi stared with me in mute horror. I had to admit it. He could be right. Chapter 15. We crept into the camp, passing one at a time through a smoldering hole in the puffcrete walls. The rim of the hole was still smoking, and I crushed hot embers with my boots as I slipped inside. We'd expected to find piles of dead inside, and we did. But they were mostly lizards. Our own dead were stripped of equipment and left to rot, every last one of them.
"Where are they?"
Carlos asked loudly, spinning around and lifting his arms into the air. There aren't more than 1,000 of our dead here.
Quiet, I ordered. Someone stripped these bodies. The only question is, who did it?
He snorted at me and dropped his rifle.
What's the difference? There's no one here. Don't you get it? They pulled out. They checkmarked us as lost underground, and after getting hit hard, they pulled out. We're totally screwed.
A minute ago, you were certain they'd wiped.
Yeah, well, this is probably worse. I can't believe it. They just ditched us. I mean, a few recruits I can understand, but Harris and Graves? They were loyal Varus troops, you know? Graves even cashed in his chips to give us a chance to march out.
Maybe, Kiwi said. Or maybe he knew what was going on, and he bailed out on us. He knew they would revive him, so he ditched us down there.
We all looked at her. I frowned. This rumor mill was in high gear.
That doesn't make any sense, I told her. You're all panicking like a bunch of splats.
I turned back to Carlos.
Pick up your rifle, recruit.
Carlos laughed.
Make me.
I aimed my rifle at him.
Graves left me in charge. If you don't want me to test our revival equipment today, you'd better start listening. Pick up your damned weapon.
Carlos grumbled, but he picked up his rifle.
Let's go to the tech bunkers, I suggested. Maybe they left some equipment behind.
They followed me to the tech bunkers, but they were pretty much stripped bare. We spent the next hour searching the place. The humans were gone. It was clear they'd suffered a massive attack and then pulled out.
Here are the skid marks,
Carlos said, indicating deep furrows in the land. I looked at them. They did indeed look like the footprints of a lander.
You believe me now, McGill?
Yeah, I said, nodding.
Anyone find any comm equipment? Anything powerful enough to reach space?
No way,
Carlos said bitterly.
That stuff costs money. They would never leave that behind. Fortunately, recruits are almost free.
I had to admit I was beginning to buy into Carlos's doom and gloom bullshit. I didn't want to, but I couldn't deny how things looked. We'd been written off.
All right. Did anyone find anything useful? I asked.
I found 2 crates of food. I've got a few uniforms, but they're ripped.
I moved immediately to check on the damaged uniforms. I grinned.
AC units look good. We'll use these for spare parts.
Carlos hooted at me and shook his head while I dismantled my pack and plugged a new one into place.
The batteries will be dead in a few days, you know.
I closed my eyes and sighed in pleasure as the cool air slipped into my suit, blowing it up like a wet balloon.
I don't care, I said. At least I won't die bathed in sweat.
We gathered water next and drank a lot of it. We found a few medical odds and ends. I unzipped at around midnight and let my teammates work on my back and legs. There were plenty of other injuries in the group as well. We had to rub them down with antibiotic salves and skin growth creams. They tingled after that. I could feel the freshly growing skin. It was rubbery and numb.
This is worse than a revival,
Carlos complained. For once, I agreed with him. When you were reborn, at least you didn't have to go through the pain of healing wounds. It was about 2 hours later that our sentry shook me awake. I got up, grabbed my rifle, and crept out of the bunker we were hiding in. The rest of the team were awakening and following me. There were some murmured complaints, but everyone shushed one another. We used hand signals and our tappers to communicate. There was something outside, something big. It was a machine of some kind. I eyed it, and it took me a moment to realize it was an air car. Cruising at an altitude of about 50 meters, it glided slowly over the camp. All the running lights were switched off.
What are they doing?
Carlos whispered nearby.
Who are they?
How the hell should I know?
He shut up for a second, and we all stared. The air car came lower, and we could hear a soft thrumming sound. It was remarkably quiet for a machine of its kind.
That thing costs some money, Carlos said. That isn't standard tech. Someone had to buy that from Galactic with hard credits.
He was right. I knew what air cars normally sounded like, and this one wasn't a noisy, buzzing machine. They usually used fans and turbojets that roared loudly enough to be heard a mile away. I frowned at the machine. I was under the impression it was sneaking around, observing. I didn't like it. I pulled out my rifle and sighted on the exhaust system.
"You can't be serious," Carlos said. "You don't even know who's in there. It could be our own Tribune reviewing the damage. If you bring him down, Varys will fry you."
"You want to walk out there and signal them first?" I asked.
No.
"Right. If we shoot that thing down, our team will know we're alive."
"What if it's an enemy?"
"All the more reason."
"And what if it's Legion equipment and you kill the occupants?"
I shrugged. "That's what revival units are for. Besides, no aerial units are allowed on this mission. It's part of the contract, remember?"
"Oh, yeah."
"All right, team," I said. "Take aim. Concentrated fire aft portion of the ship. Let's bring it down. At the very least, we might get a radio aboard big enough to communicate with Corvus."
There was no more hesitation from my team members. They were desperate and scared.
"Mark? Fire!"
We all opened up. We only had light snap rifles, but the air car wasn't armored. There was a shield, but aiming at the exhaust ports bypassed that in many vehicles. The exhaust had to have a way to exit the vehicle, so the shield didn't cover the vulnerable area. The bullets splattered the vehicle, creating a shower of orange sparks in the night. All in all, I'd say we were lucky to get a critical hit before it could rotate the exhaust section away from us. The aft fan cut out almost immediately. The craft wobbled and the nose tipped up. I could hear it revving, showing the pilot was trying to get away. But it was hopeless. The air car slid downward at an angle and went into a spin. We got up, whooping, and charged after it. The car crashed down into one of the puffcrete walls. I think the pilot had been trying to make it over the wall and out into the jungle, but he didn't make it. We swarmed the smoking car, standing on the hood and slanting windshield. The shield sparked and buzzed around our boots. Everyone had a gun trained on the passenger compartment, but the windows were dark.
"Open up," I shouted, "or we'll shoot our way in."
The window on the passenger side buzzed open. It was dark inside. We all peered in, trying to get a look at whoever was in there.
"Come out," I said. "You're trespassing in a combat zone."
I heard a series of clicks, and then the artificial voice of a translator spoke.
"You have made a grave error."
"This is a combat zone. All non-friendly vehicles can and will be treated as hostile. Who are you?"
Carlos was on the roof of the car, and I was standing at the door. Slowly, a figure unloaded itself. I could tell right away it was some kind of alien by the way it moved. I snapped on a light, and it was startled. I'd seen this kind of thing before. It was an alien with six hands, or 6 feet, depending on how you looked at it. The limbs were long and spindly, and between them hung a heavy, bloated thorax. In a way, it reminded me of a Black Widow spider. The hands gripped the edge of the car door and it hauled its body out of the seat. It moved slowly, almost painfully. I wasn't sure if it was injured or just being cautious. Then again, maybe it moved at a sedate pace naturally, like a sloth. It was bigger than a human, but not absurdly so. If I had to guess, I'd say it weighed about 300 pounds, and 200 of that was probably located in that central dragging belly. Carlos made a little gasping sound when it emerged. The rest of the team stepped back a pace and gripped their rifles tightly. Unlike them, Carlos squatted on the roof over its head.
"What an ugly mother," he said, his voice full of disgust.
The translator clicked again.
"How dare you direct a weapon toward my person?"
I realized the alien must be talking to me. One of its hands extended toward me, toward my upraised weapon.
Thud!
Carlos slammed the butt of his rifle onto its head section.
At least, it looked like a head. It was smaller than a human skull, but it seemed to contain a cluster of sensory organs. The alien froze for a second, then sank down, its limbs folded underneath it.
"That doesn't look good," Carlos said.
"You killed it," I hissed at him. "You idiot! We didn't even get to ask it any questions."
"It was reaching for your weapon. You saw it, didn't you, Kiwi?"
"Just keep me out of this,"
she said, coming forward warily to investigate.
"Are there any more of them in there?"
asked Carlos, poking his nose into the interior. I pushed him away.
"You've done enough. The creature was alone and unarmed."
"Huh,"
he said, prodding it with his toe. I gave him a shove and he staggered backward.
"Just trying to see if it's still alive," he said, glaring.
As he said this, the creature stirred weakly. It didn't speak, and fluids were running from its head section.
"Kiwi," I said, "get into the car on the other side. See if you can find a comm system."
Fortunately, except for the interface, which had to be specialized for various species, galactic comm systems were fairly universal in their appearance and operation. Kiwi found a unit and quickly connected with Corvus.
"They want to know what we're doing down here," she told me.
I looked at the alien, who was no longer moving. "Tell them we're engaged in diplomatic negotiations." Carlos laughed at that. He soon had another hatch door open and was rummaging in the car.
"Hey, you know what?" he called out to me. "I think this guy is an alien. I mean, one of your aliens, James. This proves you weren't just crazy drunk the other night."
"Who said I was?"
"Everyone."
"Hey, McGill," Kiwi called out to me. "They want to talk to you."
I tried to swallow, but my throat was dry. I wasn't sure if I was a hero or a villain, but I was certain I had some explaining to do. Kiwi patched the comm channel to my helmet.
"Recruit James McGill online, sir."
"You're a recruit?"
asked a female voice. I thought I might recognize it, but I wasn't sure.
"This is Primus Turov. I asked to talk to the team leader."
I had it now. Primus Turov was my Primus, Centurion Graves's direct superior.
"I'm sorry, sir, but I'm all that's left. We lost our veteran and the unit Centurion."
"Pathetic. All right, McGill, report."
I hesitated. How much should I confess over this transmission? Were there more of these aliens gliding around the camp, ready to invade? For all I knew, this one had already transmitted for help to its Saurian friends.
"We're in trouble. We were trapped and ambushed at the lowest level of the mine by about 20 Saurians, both raptors and juggers. We retreated and fought for hours. We finally found the tunnel they used to enter the mining complex and escaped through it."
"We've pinpointed your position. You're in the middle of the base camp."
"That's right, sir. And we've just brought down an air car that was apparently spying on us."
"An air car? You brought it down? Who gave you orders to do so?"
"I acted on my own initiative. We were left here, cut off, with no..."
"What's the condition of the air car? Are there survivors?"
"We found one alien. It appears to be the same species that I encountered earlier on patrol. Identification should be much easier now that we have..."
"Listen to me, recruit. Is that alien alive?"
I'm not certain, Primus. It has suffered injuries."
"You had best pray that it is unharmed. Guard that alien with your life. I'm sending down a lifter. Stand by."
I stood there dumbfounded as the connection broke. Carlos came to me and clapped me on the shoulder.
"I listened in," he said. "Looks like you screwed up big time."
I threw his hand off and cocked back my fist to punch him.
"You fool," I shouted. "I didn't tell you to attack that alien. You are responsible for this." "Hold on. We all know who's in command here, don't we, people?"
He swiveled his head and examined the crew. They all looked uncertain. Finally, Kiwi spoke up.
"No, you did it without orders."
"Oh, yeah, sure," he said. "Right. I can see how it is.
Why don't you all just fill me with metal right now? That would be a better alibi, wouldn't it? I went nuts, you shot me down, and then...
I put the muzzle of my snap rifle against his head. He froze.
Don't tempt me any further, I said. Okay, whatever.
The lifter came down to pick us up, or rather, to pick the alien up. They virtually ignored us, shoving us out of the way. A team of bio-specialists ran in with some anti-grav gurney and carefully transferred the injured alien onto it. Then they rushed away. We followed, walking, but when we saw the ramp was already going up, we ran to it and hustled up into the ship. I found a portal and looked down at Cancri 9, which was all mist and darkness in the night. I wondered if I'd ever see this alien world again. I had to admit, I wasn't missing it yet. An hour later, I found myself facing Adjunct Leeson and Primus Turov. Neither of them was happy. The worst part was I wasn't entirely sure what I'd done wrong. As I stood at attention, I reminded myself that I'd been in this position before, being shouted at by a group of officers. I kept my eyes straight, my face neutral, and I did my best not to react to the abuse my superiors were heaping upon me. To be sure, it seemed grossly unfair. By my accounting, I was a hero. I'd led my team out of the mines, and after Centurion Graves's sacrifice, there hadn't been a single casualty added to the list on my watch. We went over the story again from the top. Same questions, same order, same answers.
Who told you to exit the mine through the shaft, recruit?
Primus Turov demanded.
No one, sir, I said. I did it on my own initiative.
And when you reached base camp, who ordered you to shoot down the air car?
No one, sir.
May I ask you again who put you in charge?
We were surrounded by hostiles. Centurion Graves decided to use our only plasma grenade on the enemy, and he delivered it by running into their midst. It was a brave moment of self-sacrifice.
Turov uncrossed her arms just long enough to motion impatiently for me to get on with my story. As he left us, he told everyone I was in charge. From that point on, I was in command of the team. She leaned forward and her butt lifted from her desk she'd been sitting on. She came close enough so that I could feel her body heat. I wanted to look down at her, but I didn't. I kept staring ahead and remained at attention.
Do you know who was aboard that air car?
This was a new question, one she hadn't posed 5 times previously.
An alien, sir. Alien to Earth, alien to Cancri 9. Origins unknown, the last I'd heard from our biotechs. It was the same type of alien I'd encountered before in the forest on patrol.
And that previous alien, you also killed him. Am I correct?
Yes, sir.
Had either of these aliens at any time attacked you? Did they fire upon you? Did they perform some other overtly hostile act?
I paused. No. The first one was in the forest full of enemy combatants, however. The second one was on the scene of what appeared to be a wiped-out camp with no living legionnaires in sight. I took action based on the situation I was in.
Turov chuckled and shook her head. She turned to Adjunct Leeson.
He screwed us good. No excuse. Nothing.
I glanced after her and frowned. When she looked back, I flicked my eyes to the forward bulkhead again.
Do you have something to add, recruit?
I just don't understand, sir. Have we identified the alien that I encountered?
Indeed, we have. That's the core of the problem. Do you want to know the scope of the damage you've done?
I was beginning to sweat. Having acted without authority was one thing, but she seemed to be indicating this matter had exploded into some kind of diplomatic incident.
I can only assume that the aliens were innocent and that we acted without full knowledge of the situation.
No,
she said dryly, heaving a sigh.
The alien was far from innocent. None of his kind are.
I turned my head and looked at her.
Who are they, if I may ask, Primus? She stared back at me.
We weren't sure at first, but now we are. We sent the data off-planet for identification, and all hell broke loose. You see, we don't have their blood samples on hand for obvious reasons.
The reasons weren't obvious to me, but I waited patiently, hoping everything would be made clear to me. Turov opened her mouth to speak further, but the door chimed.
Come in!
She shouted irritably. The portal opened and a familiar face met mine. It was none other than Veteran Harris. He looked sick. He leaned on the door frame with one hand and took a shuffling step forward.
"Veteran Harris?" Leeson asked. "What are you doing here? You should be in recovery, man. How long has it been since you came out of the revival machine?"
"A few minutes," he said.
His eyes were only half open. He had his uniform on, but it looked like he'd pulled it over wet skin and it hung on his frame unevenly.
"Get back to the infirmary."
"If I might ask to be present, sir," he said.
Leeson looked at Turov. Turov sighed.
"All right," she said. "He's your man. There should be a witness from his unit anyway. I think there's a regulation to that effect. But if you pass out on this deck, I'm throwing you out into the passageway until this is over."
I watched this interchange with growing bewilderment. A witness from his unit? What did that mean? And why had Harris worked so hard to drag himself out of medical to this scolding anyway? Turov turned back to me. She stared at me for several seconds, looking me up and down.
"It's a shame, really," she said quietly. "We value recruits like you, McGill. Did you know that? Men who show initiative and leadership. Natural-born killers who shoot first and sort the enemy out later are useful. Under different circumstances, I'd call you a hero and give you a commendation. I've handed out promotions for less, in fact."
I opened my mouth to speak, but closed it again. As long as an officer is heaping praise on you, it's best to stay quiet. She turned to Adjunct Leeson.
"Is the inspector able to join us yet?"
Leeson checked his tapper.
"He's coming down the hall now."
The door chimed again and everyone stiffened. Even the Primus looked nervous. They opened the door and a now familiar alien stepped into the room. It was none other than the six-handed creature I'd had run-ins with on two occasions.
"James McGill," the Primus said. "Let me introduce you to Inspector Zlor. He honors all of us with his presence."
I looked from one of them to the next. I didn't really understand what was going on.
"An honor to meet you, Inspector," I said.
The alien didn't look at me. It looked instead at the Primus. A click sounded and the translator scratched out words.
"It still lives. Why has this matter not been attended to?" "We thought you might wish to witness the event, so that there could be no doubt." "Get on with it, then."
Primus Turov turned to me and straightened her body.
"Recruit James McGill of Legion Verus, I hereby sentence you to permadeath. The sentence is to be carried out immediately."
Turov then took a step backwards and nodded to Leeson, who lifted his weapon. I was in shock. I'd been surprised by the alien, but I had no idea I was going to be executed. Reflexively, I reached for my sidearm, but of course it wasn't there. I'd been ordered to leave it behind when I came to this briefing.
"I don't understand," I said loudly. "Who is this alien? How can I be executed for a crime I don't even comprehend?" "James," said the Primus, staring at me. "Inspector Zlor is a galactic. One of the many species from the core of the galaxy. He is here to observe, and you should recognize him. You killed him twice within the span of a few days."
I opened my mouth, but no sound came out. I was stunned. We'd never seen the Galactics on Earth. Naturally, there were plenty of vids of their ships.
They had a vast armada that had once visited our backwater world and threatened to blow it up, but they never socialized with us directly. Like most Earthers, I'd always thought the Galactics looked like the mollusk race that had come to negotiate with us. But now I realized that species was just another member of the Empire. Perhaps they traded services, such as their diplomatic expertise. So here, standing before me on its six hands, was a true Galactic. A spider-like creature with warm, dark blood. At least I knew they could bleed like we could. Leeson worked his weapon, ratcheting the muzzle. It wouldn't do if the hull was pierced by a stray bullet. I watched him, watched his hands moving as if in a dream. I was trying to think of a way out of this, but I didn't see one. I thought about physically attacking him. That was my first instinct, I admit. I didn't feel guilty. I felt angry. What I did next came as a surprise to everyone, including me. I stepped toward Inspector Zlur, baring my teeth like an animal. I wanted to dig my thumbs into those soft sensory organs of his. If their skulls were as thin as I suspected they were, maybe I could kill him a third time with my bare hands. A gun muzzle touched my chest. I heard the chamber rattle. Six times, or maybe it was seven. It's hard to count bullets as they're slamming into your body. I fell to my knees and looked up. Veteran Harris looked back. It was his gun that had unloaded into my chest. I didn't feel pain, not exactly. It was more like being dizzy, sick, and weak. I fell forward onto my face, and I had time to roll onto my back.
"Vicious creatures," the inspector said. "They should put you all down."
Harris looked at me, and I stared back. My eyes slowly dimmed. The veteran bent down, putting his hands on his knees.
"And now, kid," he said, "you and I are even."
Chapter 16. The first thought that impinged on my brain as I awakened an unknowable time later was that I shouldn't be awakening at all. That was the entire point of permadeath. He didn't come back. But I was alive, barely. I was naked, cold, and coughing. I gasped and coughed up thick liquids, choking. I rolled away from the attendants who pushed me back down. I flopped onto an unforgiving slab and struggled weakly. "He's fibrillating. Defib! Defib, damn it!" The bios grabbed me and held me down. At the last instant, they all pulled their hands away and they shocked me. A wrenching pain bit my chest, my face, every inch of my skin.
"Again!"
Another ice-cold touch was followed by a sharp jolt. I squirmed weakly, no longer able to cough. My mouth opened, but no breath was drawn.
"He's going. We're going to have to re-roll."
"Don't do it. We're not allowed."
"He's a bad grow."
"I don't give a shit. Hit him again."
They zapped me a third time. Fortunately, I lost consciousness. When I came back to the world of pain and bright lights, which was how I now thought of my universe, I did so with trepidation. I took each breath cautiously, experimentally. No one grabbed me or shocked me this time around. I opened my eyes and stared. There was a brilliant glare, but nothing else. Was I still dead? Slowly I became more aware. I was on a slab of cold metal. There was no sheet over me, nothing. The room was cold, and I shivered in random twitches. I heard footsteps.
"You made it. Congratulations."
I forced my head to roll toward the voice. It was female and stern, but not without a hint of kindness. I stared at her without recognition for a few seconds. Then it came to me.
"I know you,"
I croaked.
"Speech?"
she asked, tapping her arm.
"A good sign. This might not have been a total waste of time. The pool was 50-50, betting you'd come out brain dead."
"You're from Cancri Nine,"
I said hazily.
"You are running the revival unit at the base.
I remembered her now, in a flood. She was Anne Grant, the woman who'd been killed after sending me out on point, the woman who'd done my first revival. It all seemed so clear, but the current situation was fuzzy. In fact, the moment of my first rebirth now seemed clearer to me than what I'd been doing more recently in the mines. It was strange how memories worked after they rebuilt a person. They didn't come back with quite the same priority structure in the brain. It was very much like waking up and being uncertain if one was dreaming or fully awake. "Yes," Biospecialist Grant said, her voice softening.
"I know you, McGill."
She put a hand on my wrist, took my pulse, then leaned over me and checked my eyes, spreading them open and looking into them. She had a light on her forehead, one that made me wince with the bright, probing glare it shot into my pupils.
"I was on Cancri 9, and I ran the unit non-stop. Did you die down there?"
"Yeah. Just once. The second time was aboard this ship." She withdrew her hands and worked on her tapper.
"As soon as you can stand, you're good to go."
I couldn't stop staring at Grant. She still had her short, dark hair and narrow, careworn eyes. But her face was pretty. I remembered that part. I almost asked her to turn around, but stopped myself in time. I was a little out of it. Specialist Grant turned away and made as if to leave. I reached out to her and caught the hem of her lab coat with rubbery fingers.
"Explain a few things to me,"
I croaked.
"Please, Anne."
The bio turned back. She frowned, looking troubled.
"I really shouldn't," she said quietly.
"Just tell me if I'm going to be normal. I heard you guys saying it went wrong."
"You'll be fine, I think. You're recovering."
"What could go bad? What should I look for?"
"Toxemia, necrolysis. There are a few other side effects."
I shook my head.
"What went wrong?" "Nothing, really. Nothing unexpected, anyway. Sometimes when we revive someone with poor quality base materials, it doesn't go right and we have to redo it. In your case, that wasn't possible."
I tried to lick my lips. They felt as dry as sandpaper. I frowned, trying to think.
"Bad materials? Why would you use—"
She leaned forward and adjusted a pillow under my neck. Then she pretended to examine my head. This put her mouth quite near my ear.
"Do you recall the circumstances of your death?"
she asked quietly.
"Yeah. I was supposedly permed, executed by—"
Anne winced as I said that.
"I don't want to hear anything else about it, you understand? Don't talk to anyone about that. Just pretend you don't remember a thing."
I thought that might be difficult to pull off, but I nodded. I needed whatever information she could give me.
"Why did you revive me?"
I asked.
"I didn't think you liked me." "Saving lives is what I do," she said.
"You know," I said, my mind wandering a bit,
"when I was first coming awake, I thought maybe the execution hadn't been done according to regulations. I thought maybe they'd revived me to do it again."
Grant looked at me with real concern. I thought it might be the first time I'd seen pity in a superior's eyes during my tenure with Legion Varus.
"No, that wasn't it,"
she said.
"Listen, I don't know what you did, and I don't want to know. I never want to hear that story, okay? All I know is they asked me to do an untraceable regrow. So that's what I did."
I frowned.
"Untraceable? The Galactics keep tight tabs on the use of key equipment like revival units."
"Why?"
"The technology would be easy to abuse, don't you think? What if a madman bought one on the black market and proceeded to copy himself a million times?"
"Oh," I said, having never thought about that before.
"Is that possible?" "No. They keep tight controls over how often it is used and for what purpose. Your regrowth wasn't sanctioned, so I had to pretend it was a test. We do that sometimes as part of maintenance. We grow a random biotic construct with expired protoplasm, then we destroy the mess that issues.
I thought about that, and I was beginning to catch on.
So no one knows I was killed and regrown? That's right. And I'm getting the hell out of here before anyone figures out what I've done. When you feel capable of leaving, which had better be very soon now, you should get the hell out and head back to your bunk. We're in the middle of your shift's rest period. Go to bed and in the morning give random nonsensical explanations that no one can comprehend concerning your disappearance from the unit.
I wanted to ask her more questions, but I felt tired and closed my eyes for a second. When I opened them again, Anne Grant had vanished. I sucked in deep breaths for about 3 more minutes before I painfully heaved myself up and stood on unsteady legs. At first I thought maybe the regrow hadn't worked properly on my knees, but with a little time and patience they held me up. I was just weak and sick. I found a generic smart cloth suit in the room, and I put it on. The suit resized itself to my body automatically. It wasn't a combat suit, but it would have to do. I knew I had a spare uniform in my locker I could change into when I got back. I staggered out into the hallway. 2 orderlies passed me, running their eyes up and down my body with strange expressions. I didn't have a ready lie to tell them yet, so I decided to bluff it through. I nodded to them and did my best to walk with steady, confident steps. I didn't even know which way to go, but I just wanted to get past them. Fortunately, they seemed too busy, so they let me pass without questions. I found the nearest exit from the medical section and left what we called Blue Deck behind. A few minutes later, I managed to find my quarters. I fell into my bunk and heaved a great sigh. I wasn't sure if it was the cheap regrow or not, but I was exhausted. Someone's butt landed on my bed a moment later. I opened an eye, fully expecting it to be Carlos, but it wasn't. It was Natasha. I smiled at her with half my face.
"Hi,"
I said. She stared at me.
"What the hell happened to you? What did you tell the brass? They've been sweating all of us since you disappeared."
"What did you tell them?"
"I died in the caves, but as I understand the story from the others, you played hero and led them out. That's about it. I don't know what they wanted."
"What about the alien in the air car? What did you tell them about that?" Natasha shook her head.
"I heard about that, but I wasn't there, remember? Carlos had some story about the alien attacking us. They didn't seem to buy that. I'm sure they'd already pulled the vids from people's suits. Our own helmets spy on us, you know."
I frowned. I hadn't known that. Or at least I hadn't thought of it that way. Natasha was studying to be a tech, so I didn't doubt her on this point. It did make sense that our superiors would have access to any vid we made with Legion equipment at any time.
"Natasha,"
I said, "what everyone should do is forget about Cankery 9. Or at least forget about the mine and the air car, all that. Spread the word. Pretend it never happened."
"Easy for me, but what about the people who made it to the end? How are they supposed to forget everything?"
"Just tell them to do it. All of us have to if we want to keep breathing, okay?" Natasha stared at me for a few seconds. Her eyes darted from one of my eyes to the next, then back again.
"You're serious, aren't you?"
she asked. Then she began running her hands over me, checking my pulse and temperature.
"You're not okay. I'm getting yellow readings on my tapper. You have a fever."
"It's all right," I said. "Just forget everything that happened on Cankery 9. Everything you saw and everything you heard about, for your own sake." She stared at me again, looking more worried than ever. She put her face close to mine.
"What did they do to you?"
she whispered. I managed a weak smile.
"Nothing. I'm just tired. I need a little sleep, okay?"
Suddenly a head dipped down over the side of the bunk above us.
"Are you two going to get it on or go to sleep? Do one or the other, please. The suspense is killing me."
It was Carlos, naturally. I gave him the finger, and he withdrew his round face, grumbling. Natasha kissed me, then gave me a worried smile and left. I felt the burning tingle of her kiss as it evaporated on